please give a warm welcome to David Day.
Good evening. Thanks to the Art Bar for inviting me to read here. I'm going to read from three different collections. And my books of poems are, they're sort of little words, worlds unto themselves, so they're very different realities. They're a bit like novels unto themselves. I find I work better in a, when I get a certain theme or idea, to work within that idea and develop it. The first selection of the first couple of poems I'll read are from one called Gothic. It's a book that came out of working with an artist named Alan Lee. Alan just won the Academy Award for Lord of the Rings. He was the originator of all the visual effects to Lord of the Rings, and then he became the art director for the trilogy. He's currently working in New Zealand now on the prequel, The Hobbit, and another book that links up all of the Lord of the Rings books. We did this book called, I did a book with him called Castles, which was sort of all the mythology involved in castles. And then I decided after a while you didn't get to build a castle and live in one by being a nice person. So we did this book called Gothic. I'll begin it with just sort of an introductory piece called The Castle. My dearest Rebecca, I love this place. All my ancestors' history is here. A murder in every room. What more could I ask for? It is strange, but despite your little infidelity, whenever I'm here, I think fondly of you. I hope you find the East Wing restful. Right now, I'm preparing a room for your sister.
So, Gothic to you, Is Gothic the grotesque for you? Like what defines it for you?
It was interesting. The book Gothic came out of, in part, this book I was doing with Alan Lee, who I was saying was the man who won the Academy Award for Lord of the Rings, who did all the artwork. Mm-hmm. I was approached by the publisher because of some other books I'd done to do the text for this. And then we came into a sort of partnership. We did many books together after that. Alan is just one of the best fantasy and artists of the century. I mean, he's brilliant. And we just got along so well because he's one of the few artists I ever ran into who actually read a lot. Most artists are, you know, keep a concept and then go with it, but he actually read deeply in Celtic art and mythology.
Right.
And so we just connected up. And so after we did the book called Castles, that Ian Ballantyne published, I just sort of got to thinking, it was sort of like behind, you know, in my subconscious about the people who got to own castles weren't nice people. You know, and there was just like all these horror stories behind each one of these castles that were basically torture chambers. And
I thought I heard some Bluebeard in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And the point was that there's a few poems that I wrote in the Gothic book. They're about people who have murdered children and stuff. And both Alan and I had children who were about 6 years old at the time. And like the furthest thing away from you could get would be this kind of monster who would do it, which became kind of appealing as an exercise in the imagination on how to extend your imagination to include these people. And of course, you know, there's influence for everything from Coleridge to Edgar Allan Poe in that kind of imagining. So this book came out of it. It was really kind of an exercise on how far could you push your imagination.
Right.
This is a quite different book, probably fortunately for you. It's called Just Say No to Family Values.
my friend Tom Wayman is going to read next, and I were just talking about the difficulties of trying to teach poetry or talk about poetry. And I want to say it's one of the pleasures of my life to read with Tom up here. He's been an inspiration to me in the past and a terrific poet. This poem is called Jack's Chair, Don's Cat, and the Art of Not Writing Poetry. And it's for a poet named Jack Gilbert, who's a terrific American poet, who managed to basically keep out of America for most of his life and is much better for it. Talking to Jack about that remarkable poet and enormous fat man, Theodore Retke, how one day, so frustrated with his students, he stepped out of his classroom window. He stood teetering on a precarious ledge, 5 stories above the pavement, clinging like a beetle to the brickwork. It edged his huge body all the way around the outside of the building, then sweating and trembling, climbed back into the room. "There," he gasped with an unsteady voice. "At least that'll give you dumb bastards something to write about." What does it take to make a poem? Jack is unimpressed. That's pure anecdote. I don't want anecdotes or stories. I want a poem from nothing. I want a poem, says Jack, looking around for something. I want a poem from that chair. The lonely chair stands blankly in the middle of a stone floor with a white wall behind it. It's sturdy and handmade with a woven reed seat. It looks like it might have belonged to Van Gogh or even Gauguin. But I don't feel the turmoil or sense the dervish brushstrokes of madmen slapping paint on canvas. It's just a bloody chair. And this is Greece, not France or Tahiti. Besides, what I want to do is take you outside into the sunlight. I want to tell you about the miracle of the fire on the mountain and the mad priest mounted on motorbikes holding aloft icons and sacred relics. But Jack doesn't want any of that. He wants this chair. I want to talk about the woman the islanders call the daughter of the wind, or the story of the blind snake and the poison hand, but no. Instead, we got to talk about this goddamn chair in the middle of this white room, and we've got these 2 guys sitting there drinking ouzo, discussing what poetry is not. But it's just a goddamn chair in the middle of a room with a Greek sun shining through an open doorway. I think I'm shouting. The poems, the anecdotes, the stories are all outside, out in the world. But already I can see this is not true. In a moment of our mutual distraction, we haven't noticed the entrance of an anecdote in the form of Panayotis, the Greek landlord. He's just removed the chair. So here we are, 2 philosophers discussing art and life, staring at a blank, whitewashed wall. Yet about poetry, I've always liked what our mutual friend Don says when someone hands him a poem that's not a poem. Actually, to tell the truth, Don doesn't say anything. He just reads it attentively. Then there are several moments of embarrassed silence before someone figures out how to change the subject. However, much later, he will explain that it's like someone handing you a dead cat. I mean, I can see it's a cat, Don says. It's got all the right parts, and they've been assembled properly, but the cat's dead. A poem's a living cat. This thing's a dead cat. I don't know how to fix it. It's just a dead cat or a not poem. What else can you say? So what am I saying on this page? Search me. This obviously isn't a cat or a chair. And I'm not even trying to write a poem. I'm just scribbling this down in short lines to irritate Jack and Don. Also, I love to piss off librarians who are always looking for a category. Just call it a non-poetry. Just call it non-poetry, which is not poetry, in the same way that non-fiction is essentially not fiction. The problem is, I never set out to write a poem. Not ever. You see, I used to be a lumberjack. Then I started writing things down. I was trying to understand something. Then it became something else. I wrote down some more, and time just marched on. As I get older, I understand less and less. The good part is I don't seem to care anymore. Soon, I will be like this page before I start to face it. Or like the wall behind Jack's chair. Empty and totally blank, but shining white, pure, almost perfect.
Your poems, all of them pretty much seem to sort of have characters and narratives. I mean, sometimes the character is you, but a lot of time it's you talking to somebody else.
Yeah, often. I think like each one of my books is a separate reality. My first book is probably the closest to me in the sense that it was about working in logging camps in British Columbia, but at the same time there were voices of the people around me that were doing it. It was kind of a... listening to this, all these different voices that made up the world that I was living in logging camps, which I did for about 5 years, and I liked it very much. I was good at it. I grew up in that kind of community with Native Indian guys and lumberjacks and stuff. So, I would rate a lot of the Native people and a lot of the lumberjacks with any poet around in terms of their ability to tell stories. They told brilliant stories. And they also knew the power of an image. Like one of my poems in the first book is a true story of a guy cutting into a tree and blood coming out of the tree. Well, that's straight out of Dante's,
right?
The Infernal. But in fact, what it was, he cut into a big cedar tree just after the snow had melted, and there was a bear still living in the tree, and all his blood started coming out of the tree. And it's such an archetypal image,
right?
So much of that mythology, it comes from real direct experience of life. And I suppose that was that one book that I did. All the books I did are almost like novels in a way. The poems all are directly related to the reality of the world of that particular book.
Right.
And they're linked, but they're sort of linked only in the sense that like a novelist would have one novel linked to another one.
Well, it's interesting you're talking about sort of working in the as a lumberjack for a while, and I'm not sure if that has any standing on it. But when you're talking, a lot of time your poetry sort of taking the piss out of sort of high flown ideas of poetry and art by sort of attacking them with plain talk.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I think that's. But I would almost say that Ezra Pound did the same thing. I mean, like he was going like. He destroyed a lot of the Victorian sense of what poetry was, and saying like he's going back to the direct language, the absolute language. And I think in the 20th century, that's what we do, if we're doing it well. I'm not sure how well I'm doing it, but I feel like that there is a kind of artfulness that goes on in poetry that is just for its own sake, I think like it's just a matter of direct speech. I think the foundation of my work is probably imagism in a way that the most powerful way of conveying things. Our memory system works on visual image, and if you can put together a series of visual images. I worked as a journalist in Britain for a number of years as well, and I realized that poetry and journalism are the same thing if you do it well. You present a very powerful image, you hit them with a powerful image, and then you make a progression to the next powerful image. And if you can do that well, you can become a good journalist or a good poet. And I think it's understanding how the human mind works, that's how you progress from image to image.
You have a good lead, you have economy, you have a picture. Yeah.
And you're eliminate. I mean, I'm not going to eliminate the possibility of the fact is that there's a great deal of lyric aspect to language that is very seductive, and if used right, is brilliant. But you can also get carried away with that and go too far. And, you know, I realize that with my own poetry. I can get off topic if I'm, you know, pushed along that. The rest, I find a lot of stuff in modern poetry is sort of gamesmanship that I don't have much patience with. I mean, I've tried to think my way through it. I've tried to go, well, that's very clever, that's sort of interesting. But it's off the point. I mean, it's off the... It's not communicating with people. It's just showing how clever you are. And I'm not really interested in that. And, all power to people who are doing that, but I'm just... it doesn't interest me that much.
And finally, extinction. What prompted you to dwell on all the extinctions?
Oh, well, that sort of comes easy. I think... When I was about 12 years old, I went into the Victoria Provincial Museum in Victoria, British Columbia, and there was a stuffed specimen of the only Dawson's caribou. It was called Dawson's caribou. It was the only miniature caribou that ever existed on the Queen Charlotte Islands. And it was the result of an academic argument. The Dawson's caribou, it was a miniature form of caribou, and there was one example that they had in the museum, and they said there was this big academic argument about whether it existed or not, because it was a wrong climate for a caribou to live in. It couldn't be there. And so they put out a reward around the 1912s, and they put a reward for anybody who could bring an example. So somebody went up and shot the last herd and brought it back. And it was sort of like this haunted me in a way. And I started looking into it, and I was involved with Greenpeace in the early years. And I when I was in Britain, I did a book called The Doomsday Book of Animals that Prince Philip did it for. It was an encyclopedia of all the animals since the dodo that were wiped out. And it became kind of the textbook on the subject, really. It's still the standard work, really, on the subject. I got all these artists to do it, and it was quite successful. And it was Time Magazine made it one of the top 20 books of the year. But what happened was I wrote a sequence of poems about it that won one of the CBC competitions when Al Pretty was on the thing, and I was one of the judges, and I decided, like 20 years later, he said, well, I want you to write more poems about this. And I finally came back to it. So now I've done this entire book based on that.
So Al Pretty did it.
Yeah. It's dedicated to him.
The last poem I'll read is called Methuselah's Turtle. It's from a book. It's called Nevermore. Many years ago, I did several books on the extinction of species that were nonfiction. This book is called Nevermore, a Book of Hours. It's about meditations about different animals that became extinct. And it's supplemented with poems by each one of them. Marion's tortoise was an animal that was... most people know about the Galapagos tortoises, the giant ones. There were different ones on each of the islands, and they wiped out all but about five of them. And the ones you see are all from those five different islands. The same was true on the Indian Ocean, and all of those were wiped out. One of the last ones was an animal that came from the Seychelles and was brought there by the French, and it sort of lived for a good 200 years. It was at least 200 years old before it died. And it died by falling off a parapet on the island. It went through the French and the British and a whole series of other things. And my theory is that after 200 years, it hadn't been laid, and it just jumped off the parapet. Because, I mean, it wasn't unfamiliar with the place by that stage. Anyway, this is called Methuselah's Turtle, and it's about the last, being the last of your species for a few hundred years. It's a little depressing, but... Methuselah's Turtle. In the year 1918, Marion's tortoise suffered a fatal fall. He was 200 years old, if he was a day, when he toppled from the Mauritian garrison parapet. Who among us could imagine what it was like? Death is before me today, like the sweet scent of myrrh rising from a thorn tree in the desert. In 1766, a decade before the American Revolution, already grown and the last of his race, he was brought to the Seychelles, from the Seychelles to the garrison of the Chevalier de Marion. He outlasted the Bourbon kings, the Emperor Napoleon on his lonely isle, Bismarck and Queen Victoria. He kept an even keel, even as a Titanic turned turtle. He survived the years of the Great War that ended the power of the Kaisers, the Ottomans, and the Russian Tsars. Death is before me today, like a strong wind filling the sails of a great ship. To the French and the English in the garrison, he was the soldier's mascot, the embodiment of steadfastness and endurance. And the island's Hindu Lascars and slaves had an ancient legend ready-made for him. He was Chakwa, the great tortoise upon whose back was heaped the weight of the whole world. And perhaps from his own enslavement, through generations of exile and captivities, they understood something of his suffering. Death is before me today, like the desire of an ancient prisoner to see his home again. The tortoise's fall from the parapet was an unlikely accident. Blind or not, after a century and a half on the garrison's corridors were no mystery. His own time had long passed. The weight of the world did indeed rest on his back. The air above his carapace was empty, yet heavier for all that with the weight of time. Not quite the immortal Chakwa. He was not the Spiritus Mundi, not the footstool of Venus, not Methuselah's pet, but only a lonely mortal tortoise. It was time to join the others. This was the end of his race. It was time to see his home again. Thank you.